TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This archival recording of Design Matters took place in April of 2016. This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. For 11 years now, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative types about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about. On this podcast, Debbie Millman talks with composer Nico Muley about his music and about the musicians who interpret it.
I always feel like they appreciate something that's detailed on the page to indicate that I know what I'm talking about, but with room for them to continue the conversation when I'm dead.
Here's Debbie Millman.
We're listening to music written by Nico Muley, who composes chamber music, orchestra music, operas, music for ballet, film music, you name it. If we had to sample from all the types of music he's written, and he's only 34, we'd be here for quite some time. Nico Muley is a rare bird among contemporary classical composers. He's hip, and he has fans under the age of 30. Maybe this has something to do with his collaborations with Bjork, Grizzly Bear, and Ira and Philip Glass, and his efforts to reach beyond the classical music tradition. He joins me now to talk about his music and his life. Nico Muley, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Nico, is it true that you think the score of Star Wars is like a yak carrying people?
Did I say that somewhere? Well, I mean, it does do some heavy lifting, doesn't it?
Now, when I first started doing my research on you, it was before Star Wars, The Force Awakens came out, and you said this before The Force Awakens came out, so I was wondering how you felt about the new score.
I mean, it's almost more heavy lifting now, because we don't know what's going to happen in all these new themes and all these new people.
Yes.
Right, and so the trick that score does, and when I say heavy lifting, what I mean is, it's a kind of blunt object, right? It's like, this is evil because this music tells you, before
dun,
you know,
dun,
exactly.
Dun, dun,
so,
dun.
And that's an example of the music knowing the plot before the people who are in it. That's what I mean. It's sort of pulling things rather than being pulled by it or floating over it.
I sometimes get very freaked out by music that accompanies television shows or movies that I'm watching on television or on my computer where I have the real control to adjust the volume.
It's always the wrong volume.
And they're trying to get the sense of thrill and anticipation up so high that the music becomes unbearable.
This is true. And I think a lot of what happens now is that people who are making this kind of media, particularly in TV, get addicted to these big sort of Wagnerian huge film scores. And then when they're in the edit room, right, they're temping the TV show with these gigantic expressions of kind of, as you say, like tension or romance or whatever. So you end up with these kind of slightly overblown or overbearing scores, right? When you actually just need a sort of a husky, you've got a yak.
And there are times when even just silence might be enough.
You think? I mean, this is always the thing. It's when you think about the great, 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 great film scores, it's like Rosemary's Baby, right?
Yes.
Where it's like, there's a little voice here, there's a little trumpet there, but like really nothing much
and
happens.
And that's scary.
It's real scary.
You were born in Vermont.
True story.
You spent your childhood between an 18th century farmhouse in the little town of Tunbridge, Vermont, and a home in Providence, Rhode Island. Where did the name Nico come from? I have this romantic fantasy you were named for the singer and Warhol superstar.
I wish it were so. It's just Nicholas, but with the French spelling. And Nico is like a pretty... And my mother's family is French. And so Nico is one of these sort of useful... Every country in the world knows how to pronounce it, with the exception of the United Kingdom, where I'm forever Nico.
Ooh, okay.
I know. It's bad. I think it's something about going from the long E to the O that they feel is like pornographic in the mouth.
In addition to being a French, your mother is a painter and a teacher, and your dad is a filmmaker. That must have influenced you quite profoundly.
Yeah, there were a lot of ideas going in and out of the house. My father is one of these sort of eclectic filmmakers, so he worked a lot in Egyptian archaeology, but then in stone cutting, which I hope we talk about later because I'm obsessed with it, and then in sort of caves in South Africa. So he was one of these sort of documentarians for hire, and as a result knows sort of 82% of the available information about like 400 things.
When you were 7, I read that you spent some time living near an archaeological site in Egypt where you were chased by a pack of wild dogs.
This is true. It's totally true.
And so how did that happen and how did you get away?
I think my dad was working on a dig. I don't specifically remember, but the structure of this town was essentially, it was families of tomb robbers who had robbed a tomb, sold the things, and moved in. And this had happened, you know, in the last 300 years or something. So it was one of these vertical necropoli. And for some reason, my parents were down, or my mother was down there, and I was up here. And, you know, as is the way in a lot of the developing world, there's just randomly dogs everywhere.
Yes.
Kind of,
yes.
With their own itineraries, but sometimes they just decide sort of that you might have something of interest to them. So I probably had like an apricot or something, and then I was running really, 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 really quickly. And it's a kind of, for me, it's a sort of abstract memory. But of course, for my mother, it's this kind of, you know, Grimm's fairy tale. Like, it's a very specific memory for her.
Is that when she created the painting she titled Evil Nico?
That's a different painting. That's a larger scale painting. The dogs of Gurna, I actually have, and she painted that episode, and I have it in my, I have it next to the mirror that I use to get dressed in the morning, essentially.
So you look at yourself being chased by dogs every day.
It's actually the sound of me being chased by dogs. So there's no physical depiction of anything. There's this kind of blue space, and then there's this kind of sonic representation, which strangely, actually, in my mother's shorthand, her sound waves look like good Wi-Fi signal. So there's a sort of that which pleases me. I love nothing more than full bars.
That's amazing. And so what is the portrait Evil Nico depicting?
That depicts me as a young boy holding the hand of what would be the shape of my mother if she hadn't been erased into the landscape that surrounds her.
Ooh.
The symbolism of which you can
yeah.
think about for a minute.
Okay, so what should we talk about? The symbolism of that or stone cutting?
I'm at your service.
Well, let's talk a little bit about stone cutting. You said you wanted to talk about it, so what do you want to talk about?
I was just thinking, you know, one of the things my father made when I was much, much, much younger was he made a film about a family of stonecutters in Newport, Rhode Island, who own this thing called the John Stevens Shop, which is apparently the most continuously family-owned business or something. Fudd Benson and his son Nick Benson, who have been carving stone for, you know, two generations now. And it's an unbelievable place because it's this combination of the gorgeousness of typography and the gorgeousness of a font combined with the very physical manual labor of what it takes to make those cuts. That, to me, is like a completely fascinating intersection because so much of what I do is, you know, based on this on musical notation, which once upon a time would have been very, very physical in terms of, you know, you write it by hand and then the process of engraving. And it's still called engraving, but of course we're just doing it on a computer.
Right.
So to see people arranging text for, you know, memorials or the name of a building or gravestones or, you know, whatever, it's again this combination of art and function that I find like borderline erotic.
I do too.
Don't you think?
I mean, absolutely.
If you see a great R, do you know what I mean? It's just the best.
Are you kidding?
Right, or the number 9, it's like the best thing in the world.
And or the sharpness of an E, a lowercase e.
Yeah, exactly.
That curve and the sharpness, oh my God.
There's so much to love about it. And then you realize there are rules about it, but so much of it has to be eyeballed in a crazy way.
Oh, like, yeah, because you can actually center something and it won't look centered.
It won't look centered, exactly. Yeah. And this is true in music as well, right, where it's like what we refer to as classical proportions, right, in Mozart. Like, I think if you obey those rules, perfect, 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 nothing actually sounds, there's something off about it, it sounds like something's wrong. And so you kind of have to back up and look at it. But I think, again, what makes me so happy about stone is that you can't mess up. I mean, you can sort of try.
Well, if you mess up, you have to figure out a way to make it part of the actual piece,
or either you add a little,
a flourish, a ligature,
Yeah, I mean, ligatures. I mean, it's every time I go to these, you know, those places where they dress up like it's the 17th century.
Yes,
I went a million years ago to St. Mary's in Maryland, where my boyfriend went to college, and there was a guy running the print shop there. You know, again, was sort of fake 17th century introducing himself.
So really cute little hat. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Those triangle hats.
So of course, I like immediately was like, I need to see every ligature. I need to see the FL ligature. I want to see when this came from here. And because he knew, because certain ligatures only come up in like one psalm, right? So you, but it's like, did they have it? Did it come? Did they make it special? Were they using it? Were they not? Because if those frontispieces especially.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're the ones that were really decorative.
Super decorative. But sometimes you can tell when it was made because they didn't have a ligature in that place.
Yes.
It's so fabulous. Anyway, it makes me insane. And I think about it like, you know, 4 hours every day instead of writing music.
Well, I understand you sang in a choir at Grace Episcopal Church in Providence. Was that your first foray into music?
More or less. I was sort of simultaneously when I was maybe, let's say, between 8 and 11, I'd started playing the piano because there was a piano in our house.
In the basement, right?
In the basement of our house in Providence. So basically, I sort of took piano in the way that kids take piano. You just kind of go once a week and, you know, devote yourself to it as much or as little as you can. And then a friend of a friend said her son was in this choir and that it was kind of strange and interesting and I should check it out. And I went. It was very strange because it belonged to a tradition of music making that's pretty specific to England, which is this sort of chapel tradition of music that happens at certain times of the day and that music that happens at certain times of the year. And it's a sort of unbroken chain from like the 1500s. And so to find that in Providence in the 90s, even though I didn't know what it meant, it felt weird and special. And I got kind of addicted to it. And I certainly got addicted to that music, particularly the music of the sort of English Renaissance.
In the video that I watched wherein you talked about the piano in your basement, you also talked about feeling like you came to composing rather late and talked about how there are children that are born with a bow, as you put it, or playing Chopin as soon as they come out of their mother's womb. Really? Were you that late? Do you consider yourself that late?
A little bit. Let me put it this way. There exist structures for preteen kids to study music that are pretty almost professional. And I think if you go to any big city in the country, you'll find a lot of such places where it's like, you know, it'll be like Saturday school and Sunday school, and there'll be a kind of rigid way to play the violin, essentially.
So that would be taken by a young child whose parents thought that they had some natural talent.
And sometimes the kids are into it, and you know, that's a different argument. But essentially, all I know is when I turn up at Juilliard, a lot of people had been at it for much longer. I have a friend who plays in the Boston Symphony, and her house is covered with pictures of her at the age of like 2 and a half playing the violin. And you think,
wow,
it's really crazy.
But how do you bring a natural sense of joy to playing when you're sort of forced to play at that age?
This is an argument that I've never quite bought, because here's the thing. Playing music is so awesome that even if you're forced to do it, it's great. I think of it in the sense where if you can kind of get over that initial resistance, which I think a lot of kids have anyway, to anything they don't know how to do. Doesn't matter.
Adults too.
Exactly. I've never quite bought this, like, you were tortured and made to play the clarinet. I mean, yes, you were probably tortured and made to play the clarinet, but you were also tortured and made to, like, you know, learn trigonometry or something. And we all make it through somehow. But at some point in your life as a child, I hope, you think, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, Mom, I hate you, Dad, I hate you, clarinet teacher. And then something happens, right? And when that thing happens, and from that point on, you're done. Like, you're in it forever. And I think a lot of kids, even, I saw this again a lot at Juilliard, who definitely would have been, you know, had been locked up in a basement in Korea since they were 2 years old. And then, but they had that moment at age 11, and it was like, okay, now I'm in this to win it.
What was the first piece of music you ever bought?
The first major purchase was the Complete Works of Stravinsky, which came in a box, sort of a lunchbox-sized thing. And I remember I bought it at Tower Records in Boston, and I felt like a really big deal.
I understand that you also have a guilty pleasure for the Indigo Girls.
Totally. So whenever my boyfriend and I make a sort of domestic plan about, like, who's going to take the dog to the thing and who's going to order the CSA, you have to have the Indigo Girls on. it just gives a sort of blessing over the whole procedure. You should try this. It works really, really well.
I actually will, because I could use a little help in that department.
Because those conversations, you certainly can't have Wagner around. Do you know what I mean? And you can't have anything that implies any kind of menace. You need a sort of...
No Law and Order SVU.
You know, you can't have SVU, exactly. You need a kind of Western Mass, like, we're all in it together kind of power of two situation.
Absolutely. I read that you were fascinated by the emotional function of church music as opposed to that of concert music as you were growing up. And you've said that church music is more directional music pointing upward, and the satisfaction of a job well done is the only one you're going to get. When you finish the piece, you don't look at the audience and smile. You don't graciously bow. And the composer vanishes too, in addition to the performers. If you are really good, you disappear. Is that fulfilling to you? Do you want to disappear?
Enormously.
That, why? And that,
I think what it is that you've made something that hits that sweet spot where it's so beautiful that you don't think that lamp is great. You think this room is great. You think my environment is great. My day is better because I'm in this situation. On further consideration, then you can say, oh, that's because this in combination with this. But with church music, you know, the idea is that you don't approach it like a play where you're sort of in an analytical sense, right? The great thing about church is that there is one thing that's happening, right? With complexities, but there's one story, right? And it's sort of like, you know, do unto others and the rest is commentary, right? Mm. So you see this in many traditions. And so... Church music is not designed to be about itself, and it's not designed to be an art that references itself. It's meant to create and direct an atmosphere that's for a play to which we always know the plot, right? Church music can do something in 1 second that is tricky to explain. For instance, if you're talking about Christmas, right, you need to taste a little bit of the gall of East of Good Friday on Christmas, right? You have to look at the baby and be like, he's going to die, right?
Wow.
In 33 years and a couple months, it's a wrap, right? And the music can do that in 1 second.
How?
Well, what you do is you shimmer on a note or you lean into a piece of text, and this can be written into the music itself or into the performance. And in the same way that if it happened in a film score, and this is a vulgar analogy, but if it happened in a film score, you'd know it. Right.
Okay.
You would totally know. You'd be like, whoa, there was, and you wouldn't say, it's because he put that harp note on the D sharp, like whatever. You would feel a tautness.
You recognize
about it. Yeah. With church music, I feel like, because again, that we know the plot. So you're hanging your art on this structure that we already appreciate. So there's room to be really weird and stylized. And that's when music starts getting interesting, right? Where you have these insane French composers who at a certain point in the 12th century just decided, what if we took these notes that were normally melodic and made them last for like a minute each, right? They gothicized notes. I mean, it's crazy,
sounds
right?
Like Glenn Branca.
It's way before many but when right. You think about it too, it's like in the same thing that happens in ecclesiastical architecture, right? That doesn't happen in vernacular architecture, where it's like, let's experiment with these highly stylized lines, or let's experiment with, this is especially true in the Islamic world because there's not much depictive art, right? So you say, okay, we have to make the letters do the joyful expression, right? So when you write a bismillah, you make it wow, and all the letters are huge and all the vowels are these like gigantic shapes, and the whole thing turns out to be the shape of a peacock. So that's, I think that for me is the fun of sacred art.
I've had a number of musicians on Design Matters over the last year, and I keep trying to find an answer to what I consider to be one of the world's biggest mysteries. Where does the music come from? How does it arrive to you? Is it a melody that you hear? Is it a series of notes? Is it fully composed? How does something arrive to you?
I think that the minute I figure that out is the minute I'll stop having to do it. I mean, I think each expression has its own way. I think if your life includes a space for music, you'll figure out how to put it there, I think. So, and what I'm saying practically is a deadline. And what I'm saying slightly less practically is you basically imitate what you've seen before. You basically take what your teachers have left you. You take what, you know, in your experience that you heard this thing, whether or not it was in a concert hall or it was in the distance or someone humming on the subway. You collect these things and they become part of an arsenal of exactly this, which is filling up silence, which is molding around or out of silence. So I think, you know, if you want to super romanticize the act of being a musician or the act of being a composer, that's one path.
Okay, but if you're writing two boys and you're writing a piece for one of the boys to sing and they are singing, "When I was 16.
Right, yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, where did that happen? Mm. How did that happen in your head?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, for something like that, I mean, I know I'm giving you more practical an answer than the one that you want, but essentially you look at the text, right, and you say, what is the goal of the – what are we doing here? Like how are we getting from A to B? Where is this piece of music going to deliver us in the time that it has to perform such a delivery, right? So it's like 3 minutes long. And from there you sort of zoom way out and you see the architecture of the journey of the thing, right? So whatever the itinerary is, which, you know, in like a classical Italian aria, right, it would kind of go up and then down or just straight up. that's, you know, that's one path. And then from there, once you have the structure, you kind of ease your way into pitches and see what works and see what doesn't work. And I think, you know, usually it doesn't work. And then you kind of get it right. I mean, the mystery of that moment is very energizing, actually, because
it's creating something out of nothing.
It's creating something out of nothing. The other thing, though, is that with classical music, there are a lot of things that are pre-composition or pre-compositional exercises. And what that is, it's ranging from what I would say, like going to the supermarket to really elaborate, like Thai mise en place, right? And I think that, you know, there are schools of modernist thought that essentially you just do like 7,000 days of mise en place and then do fussy shit with it. And then it's like, and then that's the piece essentially is this kind of explosion of the content that you've generated in advance. And that music can be beautiful and great and wonderful. And I find not particularly spontaneous, but you know, again, this is a great thing. There's another thing where you kind of buy all the things by which, and so for me, it's like that's usually a process of discrimination, right? You say, I'm not going to do this in this piece. I'm not going to use this in this piece. I'm going to use these things. The challenge is how to make something satisfying out of what you have, and then from there, that's when your technique comes into play, right? So you do a little bit of pre-composing, and then you kind of figure it out. I think thinking about it in terms of food is really useful, actually, because, like, for instance, you know, sometimes you want to, like, follow a recipe from, like, the food lab or whatever and do exactly what he says and, like, the weird Marmite. And then other times you just want to go to the store and buy, like, six things and then see what happens when you get home. So I think, you know, at least in my practice, music can go in either one of those directions.
What's interesting about music as an art form, if you compare it to, say, art, design, literature, somebody writes a book, they've written the book. Nobody is going to perform the book. Mm-hmm. They can maybe read it out loud, or they could be participating in some sort of book club. And art the same way. You know, as Joni Mitchell once famously said, nobody ever asked Vincent van Gogh to play A Starry Night again, man.
Right.
With your music, people are constantly playing it and interpreting it. What is it like for you to create something and then hand it over to somebody else to...
It's surreal. I was just talking about this the other day. My friend Stephen Karam is a playwright, and he just had this play open on Broadway. And the anxieties he was having about that were very similar to ones that I have, right? Where it's like essentially you do this thing and your craft is on the page, and then all of a sudden other people are doing stuff to it, and it's doing stuff to them, and things are happening, and essentially you've kind of vanished. It's a weird feeling, but it's one that you sort of get almost used to. I think what is tricky about it is that you have to do two things at once. The actual document that you produce, right? Being a composer, the physical job and the practical job is you're given a pile of money and you send back a pile of paper. That's literally all.
It's really paper for paper.
It's paper for paper, right? It's just here's this and here's that. So or it's like, you know, Citibank wires in, PDF out, like. But it really that's what you're being asked to do, right? So then what you do is you have to make sure that what's on that paper is really, really, really indicative of what you'd like to have happen, right? That it gives incredibly specific instructions about how to realize the thing that you heard in your head when you heard it in your head.
Is it open to interpretation at all?
Well, it is. But here's the interesting thing. The amount of room between what you write and what ends up happening, that's the interesting thing. And with contemporary music, I mean, there's so many different paths out of it, right? Where there are people who give enormous amount of freedom, Cage being a great example. Or there's a way that you can argue that all of Yoko Ono's instructions, like in Grapefruit or whatever, are scores, right? Because it's an instruction that you deal with in your own
It's a wonderful book.
It's a wonderful book. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
So for me, there's that. And then on the other hand, you know, there are detailed instructions that you can give, right? Super complicated things where you say, okay, I want you to hold the flute like this, and I want you to top that there and do this. And you can get into that mode too. So if we set up a binary, which is completely false, it is only existing in this room, don't tell anyone. You know, for me, there's a sweet spot somewhere kind of closer to the hyper-notated thing. But again, drawing it back to food, if you read medieval cookery things...
Don't often do that.
The Form of Curry. You should read this. It's amazing.
Okay.
It's really worth doing. There's a Gutenberg text. It's like, you know, just read it. The recipes are like, take a capon, stick it in water, stuff it with spices, and serve it.
Mm.
Right. It's great, but it's like, you know, now we would expect, you know, a 3-page thing with like Nigella Lawson, like telling us where to get the thing and like
what the close-ups and the salt crystals
and the other salt crystals and where, you know, where to put. And so, you know, for musicians, I always feel like they appreciate something that's detailed with room, right? That's detailed on the page to indicate that I know what I'm talking about, but with room for them to continue the conversation when I'm dead or when I'm not in the room. So I always try to be as specific as I need to be without ever being like, to cook this, stand facing the stove, lift your left hand out where you were meant to have put the salt. Dude, I mean, and there are scores that are like that, and those things can be wonderful, but there's a control freakishness to it.
I read that the first time you listened to Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians, you had an immediate, visceral, and emotional reaction to the repetition and the pattern making, and you felt that it sounded like how your head worked. I love that.
What struck me about that piece specifically, and what still strikes me about that piece...
I mean, that piece changed my life.
It's the best thing that ever happened,
changed
right?
my life.
Just the other day, I was walking in London... And I left dinner with two friends, and they went one way, and I went the other way. And I was walking by just a building. It was 11 o'clock at night. And someone in there was 200% playing Music for 18 Musicians. Like, it was so quiet. But you hear it immediately, and you're like, I know
you
exactly.
Know.
And I, so, of course, I put my ear up to the thing. I was like, and I like took a little video. The thing about that piece is that there's a million things going on at once. But it's also incredibly simple. And this is something that Steve Reich talks about sort of implicitly, but it's music that's existing for me at two different speeds. And for me, the visceral experience is one of like flying over a landscape, right? And it feeling the feeling of speed, but then also the feeling of incredible detail. So it's like you're at a distance, but also incredibly close. So there's a way that you can argue that piece is very, very slow, right? It's just these 11 chords that then you kind of zoom into the chord and see who's inside, and then you zoom out, and then you zoom in. And, it, you know, you can say that the hour is just these big breaths, right? And that's it. These gigantic kind of camera moves, right?
Yeah.
And then you can argue that it's all this little kinetic information that is interlocking and precise. And, you know, what's also great about that piece is despite its precision, there's a lot of... flexibility in terms of how long you repeat things, who's in charge, right? So there's kind of, you know, it's so you wait for these clarinets to finish this thing and then you move on and then the vibraphone does this and then you move on. So it's a kind of community exercise. And the first time I heard it, I just thought that it was such a beautiful and impossibly precise analysis of what it feels like to listen in general.
Mm, that's exactly what I was hoping you'd say.
Okay, good. I didn't say that because you weren't like holding up signs.
No, you were able to articulate something that I've wondered, you know, what is it about this piece that's so transformative? Because the first time you hear it, it does change the way
you listen
to music. I wanted to ask you what kind of composer you consider yourself to be. And then I read an interview you did with Molly Sheridan on New Music Box, and you explained that while you consider yourself a classical music composer, that does not preclude you from working within a variety of musical genres. And you stated, it's essentially like being from somewhere. I feel like I'm very proudly from the classical tradition. It's like being from Nebraska. You're from there if you're from there. It doesn't mean that you can't have a productive life somewhere else. The notion of your genre being something that you have to actively perform, I think, is pretty vile. You're laughing.
That's funny.
It's a great line, right?
It makes sense. Yeah, I stand by it.
Why do we need to pigeonhole art? Why do we need to be able to signify where something comes from or where it's supposed to go or what's supposed to happen next?
I don't know. I mean, the radical interpretation is that it's this kind of proto-colonial thing where it's like you have to make a taxonomy of the thing so that you can kill it and control it. Like, if you want to get super kind of post-colonial about it, I think that's probably what it is in the hands of musicologists who don't know better, or who do know better but, you know, don't want
to
act right.
Need to classify things.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a shorthand. And compose it as musicians, we play into it too, where people can say like, oh, I hear the like wide open skies of Vermont in the music, or, you know, with Lamont Young, it's like, you know, surely the expanses of the West are the influence. And, you know, there's a way in which that's just, it's too easy. And again, as I said, there's no shame in being like, this is where I come from, but this is where I live. And there's definitely no shame in wanting to experiment, wanting to play with that tradition. So for me, again, the classical music tradition can mean a million different things, but it's the tradition in which, you know, I cut my teeth. Like, I write stuff down. And then the thing is, the minute you say I write stuff down, the people are like, well, jazz is written down too. You know, yes, we're all working with moving definitions in a fluid way. And a great way to waste 3 hours of your day is to try to answer, like, what's the difference between a musical and an opera? Like, if you want to spend 3 hours doing that, that's great. Just don't call me.
Duly noted. You turn the classical music industry on its head with the way you do things, the way that you think, the influences that you've had on your work and the influence you're having on others. Speaking of influence. In your second album, Mother Tongue, some of the sounds included a pair of butcher knives scraping against each other, a recording of whistling Icelandic wind, and the sound of raw whale flesh slopping around a bowl, someone taking a shower, someone else eating toast, and the frying of an egg. Can you talk about how you decide to choose the instruments you use?
Sure. I should point out, you know, that I appreciate your kind words, but this is not nothing new. I mean, music,
I know.
It is the work of the ancestors that allowed me the freedom to do that, right? And it's Cage and before.
I know.
And Gershwin. And anyway, so, you know, with that particular piece, Mother Tongue, I was trying to create an archive of a language and an archive of a space. And the glory of an archive, for me, like a library being a great example, is not going in order, right? You don't move from A to B to C. You kind of, you're like, what's this, right? And the eye is drawn to things. No, I don't want to say by random, because the eye is drawn to what it's drawn to, and that's important. But sometimes it's the cover, it's the smell, it's the this, it's where it, it's the position, it's the word, it's the name of the Dutch composer, whatever it is. So with that piece, I wanted to open up the actual instrumental possibilities to the, no, I don't want to say the random, but to the wild, and to the moments when we find ourselves obsessing over, or when I say we, I mean me specifically, obsessing over little nuggets of language, obsessing over things like, you know, I before E except after C. Like, when do those things pop into your mind? And for me, it's always when you're going about your daily tasks. We don't think in sentences in our head. At least I don't. I'm not thinking like, you know, I will walk to the stove and do this thing. Instead, there's a little repetitive thing that's going on in a you know, slightly crazy way. That's something I heard, a scrap of a thing, and then I'm making toast and thinking about something else, and then that pivots really quickly to the noise of the dog outside. And, you know, so I wanted to see if I could sort of musicalize that. So that album was an experiment in folding in those sounds, seemingly drawn at random, into like what's otherwise a pretty traditional, like, multi-voice kind of, not, I say tradition, but sort of a Meredith Monk texture.
Yes, it's a wonderful, wonderful album. For lack of a better way to reference it.
Thanks very much.
You are the youngest composer to have ever been commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera. Two Boys, which was released, it's about 2 years now, right?
Yeah,
two
it was performed ago? In 2013.
So close to 3 years, yeah. It was released to great fanfare. It was your first large-scale opera. The New Yorker praised Two Boys as a bright-hearted, fearless work and declared that you handled this lurid story with thoughtfulness and compassion. And the story combines two elements rarely seen on the operatic stage, a police procedural and a dramatization of the mysterious and lonely lives of those who inhabit the darkest corners of the internet. Why did you pick this topic matter?
I'm glad that it read as being a very new thing, because in my head it was actually a very old thing.
You mean an epic story?
No, well, not just even specifically, like, if you zoom way out of a lot of the great operas, and so let's say Partenope or Così fan tutte, the Mozart Così fan tutte, where the basic premise is that there's two women and they have fiancés, and that the fiancés are kind of tricked into testing the women's fidelity. And the fiancés then pretend that they're going off to the army, and they come back, and they swap, right? And they dress as Albanians, whatever that means.
Sounds like a Shakespeare play.
Right. Well, this is, right, this is an old story, right? Yeah. They dress as, quote-unquote, Albanians in order to trick the women to see if they'll be unfaithful, right? You know, and then, of course, the women fall in love with them or whatever, and the Mozartian sort of da Ponte genius is that they tell each other things that they would never be able to tell each other in their normal context, which is the most online thing. Right. That to me, it's like the modern condition of that. It's also, I mean, this is the oldest story, right, where you can tell someone a deeper, darker truth when you're in costume than you can in face to face. And so that to me is what happens in Two Boys, where there's this younger boy who's in some kind of love infatuation thing with this older boy. But because of the situation that they find themselves in the north of England in the 90s, he's not about to say that. But he can say whatever he wants if he pretends to be all these different people. So he can have a sexually aggressive relationship with the older boy. He can have a seductive relationship. He can have a kind of predator-prey relationship. And he can say exactly what he wants. So that to me was the kind of fun of that, which is to say the internet is allowing us to deliver to ourselves the same drug that we've had in Shakespeare, that we've had in Mozart, that we've had really since the beginning of drama, right? And then also I love SVU. So I was
you
like,
and me both.
I know. I would listen, there was a new one on last night, and literally like one of the things that I have to do tonight is watch it. Because for me, right? For me, SVU is this cultural gift, right? Because it's this perfect thing that almost always has the same structure, and once a week you can obey this kind of, again, it reminds me a bit of church actually, because it's like exactly an hour and 15 minutes long. This always happens. The Eucharist happens at this moment. It's organized, right? And SVU for me is, I don't know why we all as a culture find it so satisfying, but I think it's because we love a sex crime, but we love things being put to right, and we also love a slightly sadistic relationship with our own relationship with the police.
Yeah.
And
it makes us feel safe.
And that's what's interesting about it, is even though it's like lifting up the edge of the carpet and underneath is all this kind of sex crime, it calls attention to the complexity of the city and world in which we live.
Yes.
And that's what's great about how explicitly the rip from the headlines thing is, and that's what I would try to do in Two Boys as well,
yes,
was take this real story and, you know, modify it for the stage enough that Craig and I didn't get sued. And interestingly, with those stories, you know, and a lot of the things that people said to us after the workshops of Two Boys, they were like, it's not realistic. We were like, okay, number one, it literally happened. Number two, someone said, it's not possible the policewoman at that time wouldn't know what a server is. I'm like, hello? # Hillary Clinton, like whatever. It's like these things are very easily misunderstood by people older than me.
You have a new commission from the Metropolitan Opera. They've commissioned you to compose Marnie for its 2019-2020 season, based on Winston Graham's 1961 novel that was adapted into an amazing Alfred Hitchcock movie. Who is going to play Marnie? I wish I could tell you. Anybody but Tippi Hedren in that role.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we're getting the operatic equivalent. We have a very glamorous, but I can announce in advance that I'm not going to enjoy the same twisted relationship that Hitchcock did with her. I think that's, and one of the things that I find so interesting about Hitchcock's adaptations and the stories to which he was drawn is the sexual sadism that's behind almost all of his films.
Yes.
It becomes much, much more explicit after The Birds. I mean, with Marnie, it's incredibly explicit, and that whole kind of psychoanalysis scene, I was like, you know. But for me, the allure of what he's obsessed with, I mean, I've always said that the best chamber opera in the world would be Rope. Right, because Rope is such a twisted thing,
yeah.
And you get two countertenors, three countertenors, and you just put them in a box and shake them up. And anyway,
yeah.
So if any of you take this idea, you heard it here first. Just credit me.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is your writing. You're so known for your music and your composing that I think that your writing gets really put under the radar. It is phenomenal. So you wrote this about Beyoncé. Let me tell you a story about my phone. Four times in the last few years, it has made a certain series of noises. My current theory is that the noises are generated when a critical mass of gays text one another at the same time. The first time, it was when Michael Jackson died and I was in a fever dream in St. Petersburg, Russia, having just interviewed the homeless-looking and possibly insane conductor, Valery Gergiev. The second time, it was when Whitney died, and I was absurdly having gnocchi with certain friends, and then other friends rang, and we had to pull the whole evening over to be together in this time of need. The third time, it was when I got off a plane last week in Rome, and I thought to myself, girl, not Janet, not tonight. It was a false alarm. It was just that English diver announcing that he was fucksing a man. What is this thing you have with Beyoncé?
I mean, I think this Beyoncé's on top of it. She's the best. I think that album, when we look back on the relics of our civilization after the Great Water Wars, I think that album is going to be a really big turning point about what an album is. You know, I mean, she can get away with it, but I think, you know, it changed everything. Like, you put together this collection of things, and you just drop it into the world. And I think that she's had enormous success with that since that time, too, with, like, the Formation video, et cetera. And I think what she's up to is this wonderful thing of, as a performer, as a singer, but as a curator, you know, she's getting sort of the best people in the world together and putting them together in unexpected ways. And that album was just so thrilling because there was no hype about it. There was nothing about it. It just appeared on your hard drive. And I think with her platform, she has the ability to really push things, which I think we've seen in the last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, this weird combination of a thing that I find to be completely commercial and mainstream and also weirdly subversive in ways that I think we'll figure out in you know, 25 years. And completely calculated, but also improvised. Like, you can't have predicted the influence and the impact, specifically politically, of a lot of those things. So I just feel like it's so rare to have that experience, just viscerally, to have an album turn up and be like, whoa, that was awesome, right? And I think we're seeing that coming out of the R&B and hip-hop worlds much more explicitly. Yeezus being a great example of, like, I think one of the top expressions of mania in our time, right? I mean, there's that the breathlessness and the digital silence and that whole universe is really... Again, I think it's going to change everything. But I think with Beyoncé, she's not announcing herself as a revolutionary, right? I think she's just kind of putting pressures on this thing in a really interesting way.
Nico, I think you just described yourself.
Please, you're too kind. I should be 1/6 of Beyoncé.
Well, you are extraordinary. You have a brand new CD collaboration with Philip Glass, and that is called Music for Two Violins. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks so much.
Nico Muhly, thank you so much for being on Design Matters today.
Pleasure was mine. Thanks.
To find out more about Nico Muhly and what he's up to, go to nicomuhly.com. This is the 11th year I've been doing Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions, with technical assistance by Mark Dudlick. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.